That's crazy. Yeah, Ken and I had a bad ice cube in our flip one night at a party in grad school, and I had to sneak him home that way too. But the
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke in Lethbridge, Alberta, but in Lethbridge, Alberta, not for long, because we're headed to Saskatoon soon. But how are you, Ken?
Very best. Yes, we are. I'm going to be scooting back across the prairies, running back to Saskatoon for actually the third time in the last couple months. So
that's right. That's right. Yeah. Nice homage to the classic Canadian rock band, the Guess Whom there. And so how are you, Ken? Is it windy there?
No, the winds have died down a little bit. Spring is pretty windy here generally. But yeah, when the weather changes, so when it goes from cold to warm, or when it goes from warm to cold, you either get a blistering southwest wind for a Chinook, which was what we experienced a couple times. The bins going everywhere and lots of tumbleweed. I actually had to clean up a lot of tumbleweed out of the yard this year. And then when it gets cold, you get the smell of the feedlot that's north of the city, and these incredibly cold north winds.
That's right, listener. If you're looking for a place to spend your spring, Lethbridge, Alberta sounds like the place for you. So we're sponsored, as we are every fortnight, by the ULETH Shirk Exchange and the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick. And so we thank them for enabling us to bring this podcast to you. The attentive listener is going to notice that we're continuing to call this the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, and every fortnight we try to provide an opportunity to rename that podcast, and that's because the scope's increased a little bit in this podcast, and we also we have more listeners than we thought we were going to have, and we would like to have even more listeners because we understand that we are still thousands of listeners short of a free bottle of Balvenie Scotch, just in terms for hawking that product. We're getting closer.
That marketing room at the CAAs might be where we I don't know if they have a whiskey sponsor for this year's conference, but we can hope that maybe where it's a hotel that some lost rep from the Balvenie Scotch Company will be find himself or herself in the book room and happen upon the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
That could be. I've certainly seen plenty of people drinking whiskey and lost at the CAAs. So
that is a theme.
It is a theme. And so, but we, as I noted last fortnight, like to respect our listeners' intellectual property or IP. So we wouldn't just take a name you sent in. We would also give you a prize. And so, if you were to email us a new name for the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, where would they send that that name, Ken?
They would send it to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And aloha, Ken. I've got a prize for you here we're going to describe. I'm going to list a few things here, and I'd like you to let me know what you think of them. Okay, you ready for this?
Okay.
Okay. Reorganization of the sensory motor cortex to improve your dexterity. Lowered stress is measured by salivary C-reactive protein levels and state trait anxiety inventory scores. That's STAI scores. Positive outcomes in PTSD sufferers among veterans of wars, the Pedicodiac CRM project, or similar.
Is this a legal treatment?
Oh, yes, Ken. It's very legal. You just sit tight. Various forms of mental stimulation leading to reduced likelihood of dementia and cognitive impairment. Strengthening of social bonds among members of a community. So, Ken, what do you think it is I'm talking about?
Either psilocybin or Wordle.
You're very close, Ken. But I'm talking about playing music. And do you know what the best way to get a feel for the islands while realizing all those benefits I just described is? That's right, listener. Four bases on a ball field, four noble truths of Buddhism, four gospels, four Hindu Vedas, and four, count them, four strings on a ukulele. As a pre-hypertension survivor, no one knows more than me the importance of a self-care routine at the intersection of mind and body, and that routine is incomplete without the subtle sounds of the Pacific. And so, Ken, that's why we're offering the lucky listener who renames this podcast a series of ukulele lessons with the official J. Chalmers Doan Certified Ukulele Instructor Program. Whether your passion is the soprano, the concert, the tenor, or the baritone ukulele, and if you want to have your left hand tremolo picking, mono strumming, or bending, while your right hand is working in the George Fromboy style or the claw hammer, our teachers will have you playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow with Brutta Is in no time. And that's not all, Ken. We're sending the listener into a ukulele duel unarmed, not us. We'll be sending the lucky listener a Samuel K. Kamaka Standard Pineapple HP1 with rosewood fingerboard, mahogany neck, Hawaiian koa body, and that's not all, listener. When you're not making the melodies of the Aloha State, you'll need somewhere to put this beauty, so we're throwing in a munahe, that's Hawaiian for pro bono, a custom fiberglass case to help you imagine yourself soaking up that cool Pacific breeze. We're going to throw in 8 kilos, that's 63 lbs of high-test powered kava in Ziploc bags with New Brunswick Archaeology pod stickers on them. So listener, time that you realize the benefits that artistic expression can have in your life. Why should it be Somewhere Over the Rainbow when you can grab that rainbow by the horns and point it right at your own living room and make it right here under the rainbow? It's a big prize for the Big Island for the lucky listener who writes in now with a new name for this podcast. And Ken, where would the future ukulele impressionado send that?
Well, they would strum on over to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right, Ken. And if we open up that email address, what have we got in there?
Unfortunately, the bag is empty again. We've got some Podcorn support, and we've got our own emails booking our table at the in the conference room at or book room at the it's the book room, and what's the other? It's in media room or something like that. What is the name that they've given it?
Maybe we are the media in the media room.
Let's just see here, just so everybody knows when they're looking at their programs, the book room and marketplace. So we fit somewhere in between that. But you'll find us there. And maybe everyone is saving their mail because they want to just deliver it, not by pigeon, not by email, but in person, and query us and look for the big banner. And a couple of podcasters set up in the book room and marketplace at the Delta Saskatoon.
That's right. It's going to be we're celebrating book up culture. That's what we're going to be doing in there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So Ken, we've got a very special episode for the listener today. We are going to be joined by Dr. David Black, and he's going to talk to us about Sam Bliss's homestead and the a loyalist archaeological site in the Bliss Islands. You might notice, what are the odds, Ken, that a loyalist named Bliss would leave Massachusetts and end up at the Bliss Islands? You know, like what are the?
It's incredible, really.
really is astonishing. He must have felt really lucky. David Black served as a professor of anthropology at the University of New Brunswick for a quarter century, building the archaeology program there essentially from scratch. And his graduate work before that culminated in a master's and PhD degrees from McMaster University and launched his research agenda into the human ecology of coastal and insular New Brunswick. His major program of field research was in the Quoddy region, so that's Passamaquoddy Bay, New Brunswick, and Maine. Most of that work focused on pre-contact archaeology, especially lithic raw material analysis, paleoethnomalacology, and zooarchaeology. We'll hear today about historical archaeology that also arose out of that project. David's also published extensively, including the book Living Close to the Ledge, Prehistoric Human Ecology of the Bliss Islands, Insular Quoddy Region, New Brunswick, Canada. And in 2023, he was awarded the Canadian Archaeological Association Smith-Wittenberg Award, which is presented to honor Canadian archaeologists who have made particularly outstanding contributions to our knowledge of the archaeological past of Canada. Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, Dave.
Yeah, welcome back, Dave. And the second edition of our Great Sites. So this is the second great site in the series.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for inviting me to contribute to this. It's great to be back again.
We really appreciate it. Is Dave the first two-time long-form interview we've had on this program?
I think so, and I think you might be the first three-peat. So, you know, when you get up to five, Dave, they give you a jacket. Actually, that's
excellent.
Yeah,
that's... as long as it has lapel pins on it.
Yeah,
we'll throw the sash in with that. And so, Dave, we wondered if you could talk to us a little bit just about who was Sam Bliss. So we're going to be talking about his site. And if you could just give us some background information on Sam and, I guess, Mary Bliss and the kids as well.
Yeah, I can do that. I should preface it, though, with a couple of things. The first thing is that, you know, this was sort of me getting thrown into the deep end of text-dated archaeology, which is not something that I had a lot to do with before. And there were a couple of people who really helped me out with this, and I have to acknowledge them. One of them was Chris Blair, who did a lot of the historical research that I'm going to refer to here. And the other one was a man named Calvin Craig, who his great-great-great-great-grandfather was one of the people who was on the Bliss Islands with Samuel Bliss in 1783-84.
Oh, cool.
When he retired, he became a genealogist. He wrote a book on the genealogy of his own family, but he did contract genealogy for other people, and he really helped. He was the guy who put me onto the Sam Bliss story. You guys who were just making fun of the name, part of the reason I chose those islands to do research on was I thought it was a great name. But I didn't know what the name was about until Cal Craig buttonholed me after a lecture I gave one day and said, "Do you know about Sam Bliss?" And so this is how the excavation of the Sam Bliss homestead all came about.
Oh, very cool. And we'll maybe get the citation for that genealogy book to throw in the show notes for our listeners from you here at some point.
Yeah. And one of the I don't know if it's the article or the book, it's Living in Bliss is the title.
That was the short monograph I did for the government on the first part of the project on the year that I recorded Sam Bliss's homestead as an archaeological site without knowing anything about Sam Bliss or even where the name of the islands came from.
Oh, that's cool.
What the listener might remember from a previous episode is that Dave had started work on the Bliss Islands archaeology project in, I believe it was 1983. And was this one of the last couple of years was when you guys excavated the site, the Sam Bliss site?
Yeah, we excavated it 10 years later in 1992.
It's great.
So as I say, I got thrown into the deep end of text-dated archaeology, and I also got thrown into the deep end of one of the sort of founding cultural narratives of Canada, which is United Empire Loyalists. And it was something that I didn't know a lot about before. And it turned out to be a fascinating thing to learn about. And even now, it's one of those things that it's part of the background of Canada that's written into, even into our language. On this side of the border, we always refer to it as the American Revolution. On the other side of the border, it's referred to as the War of Independence. We're 2.5 centuries later, and we're still divided on that, you know? It's a fascinating thing.
So you mentioned the disloyalists, Dave, and who were they?
So Samuel Bliss was born in Concord, Massachusetts in 1750, and he was the son of Episcopalian minister, Reverend Daniel Bliss. And Daniel Bliss is an interesting character in his own right. He was a Yale-educated theologian, and he was one of the members of what's called the First Great Awakening, which was a religious movement that swept the northeastern United States and probably parts of eastern Canada, too, in the 1750s and 1760s. And it was the thing that wrote this sort of thread of evangelism and revivalism into North American religion that's been a major part of North American Christianity ever since. He was a strong a supporter of the British government in the 13 colonies, but that all started to fall apart fairly quickly because Sam Bliss, one of the fascinating things about his family is that they're a classic example of a family that was torn apart by the American Revolution. Sam and his older, I'm going to call him Sam all the way through this, not to be disrespectful, but just because it's a good short form. Sam and his older brother, Daniel, were loyalists, and they both ended up moving to what's now Canada after the American Revolution. Two of his younger brothers, Thomas and Joseph, were both ardent patriots, they both fought on the other side of the war.
That's pretty remarkable. And Greenfield and Concord were sort of hotspots during this war, too. I imagine that was not the greatest place to be if you were a loyalist.
They were. The other thing I should mention, too, Samuel Bliss's father, Daniel Sr., died in 1764. And his ministry was taken over by a young man named Reverend William Emerson, who 2 years later married Sam Bliss's older sister, Phoebe, okay? And this is an important part of the story, okay? Because it turns out that William Emerson was an ardent, passionate patriot, okay, who fomented revolution out of his pulpit and actually took a bunch of flack for that because he was so extreme. Then he signed on as a military chaplain during the war and was killed during the war, died of dysentery near Ticonderoga, okay? But did father several children with Phoebe before that. And they were the grandparents of the well-known American author Ralph Waldo Emerson.
That's wild.
Interesting.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that. Yeah, I caught dysentery at an ESAF meeting in Ticonderoga once, and I.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Okay. So there's connections here between the Blisses and at least some of the big names of the Revolution.
Right. Yeah. And I'm going into this in a little bit of detail, because this background is part of what sets up the real mystery of Sam Bliss. Okay. And not to keep the mystery a mystery too long, the real mystery is, why did he so desperately want to live on what are now the Bliss Islands?
It's funny you mentioned that, Ken, or Dave, because we have that written here as a question.
Yeah. What would make them attract? And so my understanding, too, is he would have, like, so he and his brothers all would have fought in the Revolutionary War on different sides. Is that right?
Yes. So he and his older brother were on the British side, and two of his younger brothers were on the Patriot side during the American Revolution. So I think it's because so Sam was 14 years old when his father died. The household is very quickly taken over by William Emerson. William Emerson is a fiery patriot. By the time he's in his early 20s, I think Sam Bliss was just tired of being under William Emerson's thumb. It's clear that his sympathies were with the loyalist side. He was what would have been called a Tory in those days, as opposed to the Whigs, who were the political party that was on the Patriot side. And so I think one of the reasons that he moved to Greenfield to take care of a store, either late in 1772 or early in 1773, was because he just wanted to get out of the household in Concord.
That's interesting. Do we get a sense of where Sam Bliss got his politics? Were they sort of before he was 14, he was already a committed enthusiast of British rule, or did he fall in with the wrong crowd? What happened here?
I think he was old enough that, like Daniel, he was influenced by his father's politics, whereas the younger members of the family were all young enough when William Emerson appeared on the scene that they were all influenced by the other set of politics. But there were probably much more complicated factors in there. So for a long time, we wondered if Sam Bliss had gone to Greenfield, which was, by all accounts, a very sort of patriot part of Massachusetts at the time. We wondered if he'd gone there because he had some patriot leanings, at least as a young man. But it turns out that's not the case. The other thing that I need to tell you about is that there's a famous incident in the run-up to the American Revolution called the Boston Massacre, where some British redcoats fired into a crowd of protesting Americans and killed five people. There is a historical document, unfortunately a secondary document. I've never seen a primary document, but that secondary document makes a very strong case that Sam Bliss and his slightly older brother Thomas were witnesses to, if not participants in, the Boston Massacre.
Oh, interesting.
And that they were firing?
No, the Patriot side of that was a protest, so they weren't firing. It was somebody threw a snowball at one of the British regulars and hit him in the head, and he got pissed off and fired a musket, and then a bunch of other soldiers fired muskets, and five people on the Patriot side were killed. if I'm remembering the facts correctly around this. So the two brothers had exactly opposite reactions to that. Sam Bliss remained an ardent loyalist, and his brother Thomas became an absolutely avid patriot as a result of that.
Interesting.
But we know that Sam was a loyalist when he went out to Greenfield, which is a little bit unusual. And this is why I think that the real motivation was he wanted to get out of William Emerson's household. And the reason that we know that he was a loyalist is because of a document that wasn't published until long after Chris and I did the original historical research on this. And this is a diary. It's a fascinating document. It's a diary that was made from 1772 to 1775 by a young man who was a doctor in Deerfield, Massachusetts, which is, you know, within easy walking or horse riding distance of Greenfield. And Samuel Bliss is mentioned numerous times in that diary. He was a storekeeper in Greenfield. The young doctor, Elihu Ashley, was an acquaintance of his. They drank flip together in the taverns in both Deerfield and Greenfield. They, for a while, Sam Bliss was dating Elihu Ashley's sister. And they womanized together. They drank together. They did all kinds of stuff together. And it's clear from what Elihu Ashley says that Sam Bliss was an ardent loyalist all the way through this. He was in really serious disputes with at least two loyalists during the 2 years that he was at Greenfield. One case ended up actually going to arbitration. It was that serious. And another one either ended up in a tavern fight or was very close to being a tavern fight.
it's funny you mentioned that, Dave, because we were discussing the beverage, the Colonial Flip, before you came on. And I hadn't realized until you sent around the recipe what coming to loggerheads must have meant. And so now I'm imagining these people swinging these hot metal irons at each other, while cut to the gills on a beverage made from molasses, rum, and dark beer, right?
Right, right. Yes, yeah. So if you put that video into the show notes, then people can watch that. And I'm hoping that what we'll do is we'll instigate a revival of Colonial Flip, because it sounds like a great drink. It'd be a good drink to make in your backyard. You just have to have a barbecue, a loggerhead, a pewter pitcher, and the other ingredients.
Yeah, I mean, this is also the recipe for the next branded NBR pod swag.
Exactly, some pewter mugs or pewter jug to in order to mix your Colonial Flip. I don't know, Gabe, that sounds like it might pair very well with a cold evening, cold November evening in Rhode Island. Actually,
it does. I mean, maybe we'll do ESAF Colonial Flips.
Yeah, well, you notice the guy in the video is making them in the run up to Christmas, so yeah. Clearly he's treating them as a cold weather drink. Yeah.
No, that's perfect. I mean, or we could possibly do, a live New Brunswick archaeology podcast from the fire.
Well, Picaroons does have a porter, and they have those little fire pits outside. So maybe we could, the next live podcast, we could see if we can muster up some Colonial Flips.
Yeah, we could come to loggerheads. I think
the whole idea of archaeologists coming to loggerheads is too good to pass over.
It is. The fellow in the video looked like he might have had a Courvoisier before he started making these beverages, too.
Yeah. Not to jump ahead too far, but did you find any loggerheads at Sam Bliss's house? That's the real question.
No, we didn't, but there's plenty of wine bottles, the big old 18th century wine bottles with the big kicks in the bottom of them and the heavy green glass. So they were not teetotalers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, to foreshadow a little bit, maybe Sam Bliss was stirring his with hot bar shot, but we'll get back to that, I guess. So we know that Sam Bliss, he runs basically a general store, right, in Greenfield, Massachusetts?
Yes. It wasn't his store. It was owned by the Reverend there, but he lived in the store and ran it as a shopkeeper. And the other interesting note, just before we pass on from the whole Greenfield episode, is that even though he was known as a loyalist and he had some difficulties with people over that, he was still in good enough standing in the community that when he realized that this was just, he just had to get out of there, and he went to Boston in 1775, he was still able to sell the stock in his store and get his money out of it before he went to Boston. So it wasn't like he had his property there confiscated or anything. That came later on.
Interesting. Okay.
And that's probably where, like, he's interpreted as being a fairly well-to-do guy, eh? So I'm guessing that the sale of the business probably lined his pockets before he headed north.
Yeah, I don't know how well-to-do he was, but I suspect that was the money he used to buy a commission in the British Army, because he was a lieutenant immediately as soon as he went in to the military, and I suspect that's because he bought that commission.
Interesting. Okay.
Before that happens, though, there's another really interesting incident. And that is, his older brother, Daniel, is practicing law. Daniel was a Harvard-educated lawyer, and he was practicing law in Concord at the beginning of the American Revolution. And he was already in trouble with his neighbors because he was an ardent Tory. And then he entertained a couple of Thomas Gage's officers in his house. Now, for officers, we can read spies, because that's what everybody else read. And then Daniel led these two spies out of Concord and back to Boston by the back roads so that they wouldn't be ambushed by any patriots on their way. And he got in enough trouble for that he couldn't go back to Concord. And about the time he ended up in Boston, Samuel also ended up in Boston. And Samuel had to go back to Concord and get Daniel's family, his wife and his kids, out of Concord and back to Boston, because it wasn't safe for Daniel to go back. And ultimately, during the American Revolution, they were both proscribed officially by the Massachusetts government, and they had their property confiscated. They were essentially banished.
That's crazy. Yeah, Ken and I had a bad ice cube in our flip one night at a party in grad school, and I had to sneak him home that way too. But they, so they're also a kind of highly visible. I mean, even this. Not being discreet about their feelings here.
No, especially Daniel was.
Yeah.
And going to Boston, I'm guessing it's that they're mixing in with, like, I don't know the American Revolution all that well, but I'm guessing that they're mixing in with a much larger population of loyalists and Tories in Boston and have considerable political protection by doing that, eh?
And military protection, too, because the British are still a military force in Boston at the time. And so it's one of the places where loyalists congregated to essentially get out of the 13 colonies during the war. So then Sam Bliss spends the war as part of what was called the Highland Emigrants Battalion, or I'm not exactly sure what it was called, but eventually it became the Royal Highlands Fusiliers. And he was a lieutenant. He spent much of his time on ships during the war. He operated out of Halifax for a while, and that's where he met his wife and got married. But he was also in Newfoundland. He was a recruiter, and so he was one of the people who went around and recruited for the regiment. He was also the paymaster, and this probably had to do with his bookkeeping experience when he was a shopkeeper.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and we think that he was in the Carolinas during the Southern Campaign. We don't know that he ever fired a rifle or anything like that, but he was probably down there. He was in New York and served on a court-martial panel there. He was in various places, and he operated out of Annapolis for a while, and he operated out of Wolfville for a while in Nova Scotia. And we think that must have been when he was first exposed to the Quadi region. We can't imagine any other time when he would have been exposed to that area, except when he was boating around as part of the British military during the Revolution.
Yeah.
Interesting. And so it sounds like he had a fairly successful military career. Except for the, I guess, the losing the war thing.
Yeah, when the emigrants became the Royal Highland Fusiliers, they all became half pay officers, and that meant that they got land at the end of the war, and that they also had a pay subsidy, essentially a pension. And so yes, he did all right out of the war.
So was his when he went to the islands to arriving in Bliss Islands, the aptly named Bliss Islands, was that his loyalist, like the lands that he was granted because he was a loyalist, or had he already claimed lands in Nova Scotia and then he made his way over to the Quadi?
No, they were not the lands that he was granted. This is a long, complicated story, and I'm not sure I understand all the nuances of it. But it's clear that he was determined, even before he was demobilized from the military, to live on those islands. Okay, so
interesting.
So the Fusiliers were demobbed in Hants County, Nova Scotia. Many of them were offered and took up lands in Nova Scotia. Some of them elected to take up lands in what's now New Brunswick and Charlotte County. And Sam Bliss was one of those. But even before he was demobbed, he and some of his buddies had taken a boat across the bay to the Quadi region and were on those islands. And 10 of his best friends from the regiment came out with him late in 1783 and stayed over, or went back and forth between 1783 and 1784, and built a house for him on the islands. And his wife and his young daughter, Sam Bliss's wife and young daughter, came out probably in the spring of that year, when the house, 1784, when the house was built. So he was, and this was before those islands were granted to him. He was granted a town lot and some other property on the mainland in what the original site of St. George. It's not where St. George is now, but the original site. And he gave up a bunch of his mainland property in order to be granted those islands. He asked for them specifically, and then he had the grant renewed in 1786 when New Brunswick became separate from Nova Scotia.
So he really had his eye on these islands.
He totally had his eye on those islands. And that's the big mystery, is why was he so determined to live in those islands? He had no background as a fisherman. He had no background as a farmer. He had, it was going to be a completely different lifestyle.
Was it just that, like, maybe it looked a lot like the islands in New England? Like, you know, it's...
But that wasn't the kind of background he came from at all. Okay. Remember, yeah, his father was a minister. Concord's not on the coastline. It may be that his wife's family had some agricultural background or something like that, but we don't know that for sure, because there's still some confusion even about her maiden name, whether she was Mary Harwood or Mary Harrod, and so it's hard to do research on what her family background was.
Interesting. Go ahead, Ken.
So, and again, we don't want to spoil things, but do you get a sense that some of what you guys found indicate that Bliss had may have been preparing for defense of his homestead? Do you get a sense that the Quadi offered maybe like a remoteness that maybe drew him there, that you know, he was isolated enough, and that maybe he had some concerns about being a guy who was one of these early sort of vocal loyalists, that somehow, you know, that there, you know, there's tensions basically between the Americans and the Brits ongoing throughout the late 18th and early 19th century. Like, was some of this maybe finding a safe spot away from centers like Halifax and places like that that could be attacked?
It's possible that that was his motivation, although I wonder about it, because if he'd really wanted to be safe, all he had to do was move to Fredericton, where his brother, older brother Daniel, had become one of the major figures in the first Loyalist government by 1784. Okay. So he was well connected, family wise and political wise, in New Brunswick as he had been in Concord. But instead, he chose to live on these islands, and so I think we should set this up a little bit for the listeners, okay? Where Sam Bliss built his house, if you had a good glass, as they used to say in those days, and we're talking about a spy glass here, not the kind of glass that you put flip into, but if you had a good glass in those days, you could see right down the Quadi River to where the American border is now. Now, I'm not sure that anybody there even understood where the American border was going to, the international boundary was going to be in those days, but it was pretty clearly going to be down there somewhere. So that's one of the possibilities, is that he wanted to keep an eye on that. But I think it was probably more he'd had enough experience with ships during the American Revolution, and it's pretty clear that he had a ship. The only reference to it we've ever been able to find is that on at least one occasion he brought a load of potatoes from Hants County, Nova Scotia, and delivered them to St. Andrews, New Brunswick, in a schooner that was called the Hazard. I've never been able to find a ship's record on that schooner. But this is the other thing to understand about the Bliss Islands. It has one of the best small natural harbors anywhere on the Quadi Coast.
Interesting. There's no chance he was a smuggler, is there?
Well, that was what I was wondering, is was he smuggling people or goods?
One possibility is that he was involved in commerce on the water, and that commerce may have been legal or illegal or a combination of those two things, okay? But the other possibility is that he actually decided he was going to set up this small estate and have a little farm and do his thing on the islands. But he was also had an eye to being protected, because privateering and raiding was a big deal in those times. And a place like that, you would be vulnerable to that sort of thing. And let me tell you, on the basis of our excavation, these folks were gunned up, okay? we found one gun flint for every square meter we excavated beside Sam Bliss's house. Okay, this isn't in his house, remember. This is in the dooryard beside his house that we're doing this excavation. And we found a cannonball.
Yeah, definitely not a smuggler.
Yeah, the gun flints all ranged all the way from pistol size to rifle size to one that was large enough that it could have been a strike light for lighting a fireplace, but it could also have been a strike light for lighting a cannon.
I would imagine that that's like, there's a lot of Charlotte County residents today that would connect with Sam Bliss and his love for firearms.
And the other thing is that on the basis of the faunal remains that are in that site, and there's a beautiful faunal assemblage from it, very, very, very well preserved. Okay. The one thing that we know they were not using the guns for was hunting. There are no wild animals, no wild mammals, no large animals of any sort, except domestic animals, in that faunal assemblage. And they were all clearly butchered with axes and knives. They were not shot.
Interesting.
Okay. So the guns were not there to hunt.
So that also potentially contrasts one of the other just obvious reasons that he might have gone to the Bliss Islands, which is that so indigenous people had found life there quite fruitful, right? There's lots of things to hunt and fish. So he's not doing that there. He's a sort of subsistence farmer?
In a sense, but they were also fishing. So one of the things that we know from the faunal assemblage is that he had domestic animals there. He had cattle, he had sheep, he had pigs, probably goats as well, and domestic chickens, okay? The only real wild animals that are in the assemblage are fish, shellfish, and some ducks and possibly geese, but the geese might even have been domestic too, for all we know. It's hard to tell from the bones. They did a lot of fishing, and we found some really big iron fish hooks, and they were taking really big codfish, largely haddock, melanogramus. And the reason that we know they're melanogramus is because many of them were so big that they have a hyperosteotic head bones. Okay, and I don't know if you know about this.
No.
This is a thing, haddock in particular in the cod family, when they get really large, their post-temporals and their clythra blow up like balloons, and they're really distinctive. We couldn't figure out what they were when we first excavated them. We had to do, you know, fisheries research to find out what was going on with these things. But they were getting very big codfish.
So this is like a bony mass on the back of the skull that you guys can identify that
when they get big and old. Yeah.
Crazy. And you said it was haddock?
Yeah, haddock specifically. Yeah. There was some pollock, and there was some Atlantic cod as well. But haddock was the big food fish that they were taking, and big cast iron fish hooks that they were using to take them.
Are they eating shellfish?
Yeah, they were also, it's a shell-bearing site, and that's why the bone assemblage is so well-preserved. There's a small deposit on it that we would call a shellman if we found it in an indigenous site. And one of the interesting things for me, because I'm all about paleoethnomalacology and I've always been midden obsessed, right, as you guys
For the listener, paleoethnomalacology is the study of shellfish in the archaeological record, or human consumed, or
so the shellfish assemblage in the site is surprisingly similar to shellfish assemblages in indigenous sites. That's one of the things that surprised us. There's two big differences. Okay, one difference is that the loyalists were harvesting scallops, okay? And there are enough scallop shells and dense enough deposits of scallop shells in the site that we know that they were taking them as food fish, okay? So they were definitely eating them. Indigenous people didn't do that in the Kwadi region. When we find scallop shells in indigenous sites, they're almost always dead shells that were collected off the beach, and they were modified to make them into artifacts. And in fact, we think they were using them for the same purpose as those clamshells that you and Matt Betts recorded and reported from Port Jolly, where they were fire keeping. I can't remember
the spark holders.
The spark holders. Yeah. That's what it was. Yeah, we think at least one of them that we found, we think, was used as a spark holder, and possibly the rest of them as well.
A use for those which remains traditional in the Kwadi region. In fact, in some ways.
Yeah. So. Just to get a sense of like the lay of the land, like I'm looking at Google Maps right now, and Bliss Islands is basically it's upwards of three islands depending upon the tide, is my understanding, and all three of them can be connected at a low tide. And there are pre-contact sites kind of distributed across the islands. And in terms of where Sam Bliss and his homestead are set up, how does it relate to the pre-contact patterning on the islands? Like in terms of the spatial arrangement of where you're finding, where you have found sites in the Bliss Islands, and where Sam Bliss decided to set up, like was there a pre-contact site that he built on top of, or did he actually just choose an entirely different place to set up his homestead?
He chose an entirely different place from the indigenous sites. So where his homestead was located, where his house was located, is on the central island, just above the bar that connects the central island and the southwest island, okay? So from his house, you would have been able to see the rock outcrops where the Bliss Islands lighthouse is now.
Okay.
And right in front of his house would have been that bar that connects the two islands. And on one side of the bar is Lighthouse Cove. Out that way, you see straight down the Kwadi River towards the international boundary. On the other side of the bar is Pintlow's Cove and Fisherman's Cove, which, as I said, is one of the most perfect little harbors anywhere in the Kwadi shore. And I'm pretty sure that's where he kept his boat, where he kept the Hazard, was probably tied up in Pintlow.
Yeah, that protected north-facing cove, basically, eh?
Now, the part of the central island that's immediately adjacent to where his homestead was is the only part of those islands that's been cleared long enough and often enough and with enough diligence that the vegetation's been permanently deflected from coastal forest, okay? And we think that that clearing was largely done by him in the late 18th century, and then it was redone and expanded in the 19th century when the Quigleys had their homestead. Their house was in a different part of the same area, but there was no indigenous occupation on that part of the island, as far as we know. There was an indigenous site on the opposite end of the bar on the south western island, but it was probably long abandoned by the time the loyalists got there.
Interesting. And I suspect, I mean, we might not have any way to know, but is there any evidence of Bliss interacting with indigenous people?
None whatsoever. I've looked very hard to see if I could find anything like that, but it's pretty clear that indigenous occupation had already been largely displaced from that part of the Kwadi region by the 1780s.
Interesting. And so stuff like their gun flints, for example, aren't local materials. Like they're probably European flints that he brought with him from New England. Interesting.
The listener won't know this, but Ken had a brief flash in his eye that looked a little bit like the color of Washtenaw shirt, I think, at the hope of the possibility that might be getting traded out.
Yeah. No such luck, Ken.
yeah, no luck. Yeah. So I'm looking at like it's a fairly large area that's cleared sort of on the southwest of that central island. And you said that Bliss probably did that himself, but you also mentioned that when he first arrived there were other folks that came with him. Is that correct? So was it just one homestead, or were there sort of, was it like a small community that he just sort of ended up staying?
We know that at least some of the people who came and helped him build his house actually took up land up the Mackadavid River. Like Calvin Craig's ancestor, for example, ended up in Bonnie River up the Mackadavid. Joel Bonnie and some other people like that, Bonnie River's named after a loyalist. They took up land up there, or they took up land in the original location of St. George, okay? I think that Sam Bliss must have had other people besides himself and his family living on the islands to look after their livestock, and particularly if he was engaged in commercial or other kinds of work with the boat, okay? Because he would have been away from the islands. He would not have been leaving his wife and his daughter. There's some confusion about whether he had one daughter or two. We know that he had a daughter who was born in Halifax before they moved to the islands. We think that there was a second daughter that was born while they were living on the islands, okay? But he wouldn't have been leaving his family out there unprotected while he was off on a boat somewhere. There must have been.
They were protected.
People. Pardon?
They were protected.
but he must have had other people there living with him and helping him.
Okay, interesting.
But we really don't know. There's no documentary evidence to suggest that.
So we don't get the sense that Mary Bliss was running the cannon while he was gone.
Well, okay. So do we want to talk about the cannon?
Oh, we absolutely want to talk about the cannon.
We alluded to gunfleds and loyalists being gunned up earlier, but one of the things that we found, one of the really fascinating things, is that right beside the house, the footprint of the house in this dooryard that we did our excavation in, we found a cannonball. And it's not just any cannonball, okay? It's not your round chunk of iron that you fire out of a cannon. It's like you take that round chunk of iron and you cut it in half, and then you put a 12-inch long, 1-inch square iron bar between the halves and fuse them all together, okay? And then you fire that out of your cannon. This is what's called a bar shot, and it was used specifically to take the rigging out of enemy ships.
Well, Dave, you know, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a self-defense cannon is a good guy with a self-defense cannon.
You know, we were astonished when we found it. We did not find a cannon. Let me underline that right away, okay? And we were very disappointed by that. There were people on the field school who wanted to get a metal detector and start running the metal detector all over the south end of the island to see if we could find a cannon right after we found that. But that didn't happen, okay? So he could have been using that bar shot as a doorstop, okay? But I doubt it.
Or a flip stirrer.
It may have been a doorstop that was serving two purposes. In the event of an incursion,
yeah, possibly so. But anyway, I suspect that he may well have had a gun set up beside the house, a ship's gun, and I suspect that if he did, it would have been aiming out over top of Lighthouse Cove, just waiting for somebody whose looks he didn't like to try landing a boat in there.
It's interesting. that's definitely got some revolutionary or counter-revolutionary zeal, doesn't it? So we're jumping around a little bit, but I think the listener would probably be interested in a little bit sort of about the practical background of the archaeology, and so number one, sort of what brought you to Bliss Islands originally, what put Dave on Bliss Islands, and then what led up to sort of late in this research program, you heading out to the Sam Bliss homestead for the work. You had mentioned that a local had kind of informed you about it. And can you tell us a little bit about the excavation itself? Like, it sounds like it was incredible results. We've talked a little bit about what you guys have found, but just sort of the practicalities around the work.
Yeah. So I don't know how deep into the background you want me to go with this, but how I ended up in the Bliss Islands in the first place doing research there was, I used to tell my students this story. I probably told you guys this story too. And I always preface it by saying, this is something that's never going to happen to you guys. Okay. So what happened was I handed the first draft of my master's thesis to my supervisor at McMaster at the end of the winter term in 1983. Okay, and it was going to take him a while to go through it and mark it up. No, actually, I said first draft. It was actually the second draft. Okay, but it was going to take him a while because it was summertime for him to mark it up and get it back to me and everything like that. And I needed to have a job. Okay, and so I called Chris Turnbull up in New Brunswick and I asked him if there was any projects that he was running that I could work on down there. And he said, "Yeah, I got a couple of things for you. When can you get down here?" So I ended up down there early in May, okay, and went into Chris's office, and he says, "I want you to spend 6 weeks on Grand Manan, okay, and look for archaeological sites on Grand Manan, and then I want you to spend 10 days on Deer Island and test a site that we found on Deer Island that's really intriguing." And but he'd hired me for 3 months, and I said, "Well, what am I going to do for the rest of the summer?" And he said, "What would you like to do?" That's the part that students don't get offered anymore. Okay, here's 5 weeks of pay. What would you like to do?
Just out of curiosity, was this funding that like was coming from the New Brunswick government, or was this the like kind of trickling down from like the federal, like the Arc Survey of Canada funding that had been going on?
Nope, this was provincial government money.
Okay,
and so what I did was I spent a couple of days in Chris's lab in Fredericton, and looked at a bunch of maps. And then I knocked on his door and I said, "Chris, look, here's what I'd like to do. I think instead of doing one coastal site at a time, we should pick a cluster of coastal sites that are close to one another, okay? And we should do it in some excavations and an analysis of a site cluster as opposed to individual sites. I think we'll find a bunch of stuff out that we don't know by doing that." And he said, "Interesting. Where would you do that?" And what I used to tell my students was I threw a drafting pencil at the map, and wherever it landed, that was where we went. It wasn't quite like that, but what I did was I had two or three places in the back of my mind. I pointed to the Bliss Islands first, and I said, "Look, here's a small island group. There's six known sites on it already that you know that just scratches the surface. There's going to be a bunch more." And he said, "Okay, go to Grand Manan tomorrow. I'll have it all set up when you get back."
That's great.
So that's how I ended up doing pre-contact archaeology in the Bliss Islands. How I ended up doing the historic archaeology was that in 1986, I worked on the Bliss Islands again. That was the field work for my PhD dissertation. The whole project had morphed into that kind of a project by then. And it was funded both by the provincial government and by SHRC at that point. And as part of that, I gave a talk at the Sunbury Shores Arts and Nature Center in St. Andrews. And after that, I met one of my heroes there, by the way, too, Carl Medkoff, who was a biologist and a shellfish guy from St. Andrews. That was one of the high points. The other high point was that Calvin Craig came up to me after the lecture and said, "Do you know anything about Sam Bliss?" And I was, to my... You know, I feel foolish about this now because it never occurred to me before that to ask, where did that name come from?
That's great. And so had you already located the historic site that was Sam Bliss's homestead at that point, and then you connected the two, or did you go out and look for Sam Bliss's site?
As well as testing the known sites, we went around and we looked for other sites to record, including historic sites. And one day, my field assistant and I were just getting ready to get in the boat and go across to the central island and look around for sites to record. And we ran into one of the local fishermen just as we were going down the shore to the boat. He was a man named Samuel Mitchell from Back Bay, who was out there attending a fishing weir at the time. And he asked us what we were doing just to make conversation. We told him what we were going to do. And he said, "Oh, look in the gooseberry patch over on that island. I think you'll find something you want to record over there." And sure enough, we did. And that turned out to be Sam Bliss's house site.
Very cool.
Completely unbeknownst to us in 1983.
That's great.
Yeah. So when we went out in 1992, one of the things we did initially was try to convince ourselves that this was, in fact, Sam Bliss's homestead.
Right. And so in addition to, you've talked about his weaponry, and we've talked about his food, but what did his house look like, and what sort of other artifacts were there?
There were a lot of ceramics, which Chris Blair analyzed very capably. There's a paper, there's a chapter in the Underground New Brunswick book that Chris wrote where he talks a little bit about the economic status of the family and based on the ceramics and things like that. Chris's interpretation, and I agree with him on this, is that they were fairly well-to-do. They were connected. They had the boat. They were able to get the current fashion in ceramics. We know from some of the metal artifacts that we found that they had, you know, furniture that was fairly high-end. At least part of their fireplace and chimney were built with bricks. The original site of St. George was on the Latang Peninsula, where there were brickworks for the next century or more. And we think that Sam Bliss may even have had a share in the brickworks.
Oh,
that's how he was able to get bricks. But we don't know that for sure, but it's a good possibility.
Share or a protection racket. I mean, we shouldn't rule that out as a possibility.
Exactly. Yes. And Chris's interpretation too is kind of interesting, that that the Blisses, the other sort of sign that they had, they were relatively well to do or sort of had a higher socioeconomic status, was that they kind of were on the cutting edge with all the trends in ceramics, basically, right? That there didn't seem to be, they seemed to have stuff very soon after those types of ceramics became available. That this stuff is coming from England, and very little, Gabe had a great liner note in his copy of that there was very little time lag between Europe and North America in terms of these ceramics being imported, and they seem to have them fairly quickly, right? Which means he probably maintained pretty close connections with folks that were getting stuff sort of directly from the UK in places like, I'm guessing, Halifax and things like that, eh?
Yeah, Halifax and St. John. And I think Chris is absolutely right about that. They were well connected. They were getting stuff, you know, pretty quickly. The only exception in terms of the ceramic assemblage is the Delftware, which would have been much earlier ceramic. But we think those were legacy or heritage ceramics that Mrs. Bliss inherited from her family and that she brought out there with her.
Interesting.
Question I sort of have for you, Dave, is that, so you're a pre-contact archaeologist, and I think that maybe is where your sort of passions lie. I think that might be fair to say. But I was wondering what you felt like as you were working on this project and as you were exploring some of this, how this fits into the broader narrative that you've kind of constructed archaeologically of the Bliss Islands. So in your mind or in your heart, where does this site fit in with the broader work you've done out there?
Well, I mean, part of it was that I wanted to construct as complete a historic sequence. And I mean historic in the big sense of that term, as complete a historic sequence for the islands as I could. And I wasn't as successful on that as I'd hoped to be, but certainly excavating the Bliss homestead was a big chunk of extending that historical sequence and narrative into the historic period itself. One of the great disappointments of that project to me is, so we know that the islands had an Aboriginal name. The Aboriginal name was Seabiscook. Ganong believed that was a term that referred to a high tide or a strong current flowing through the islands, which is certainly appropriate for a group of islands that are joined by intertidal thoroughfares and bars. Okay, there's another interpretation that it refers to the three points on the islands, and the islands are very much three-pointed. Okay, so there was an indigenous name, and then on the French maps from the French period, it was called, they were called the Latang Islands. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the term Latang has now been moved onto the mainland, onto the Latang Peninsula and the Latang Harbor. Mm-hmm. But originally they were the Latang Islands. The biggest disappointment to us was we thought they have a French name. The French must have been out there. We have never found a single French artifact from the islands.
Interesting.
That is interesting. And you were pretty, this is a tangent, but I happened upon a picture of you shirtless in 1983 working on an Acadian site in a paper by Marc Lavoie. So you were sort of familiar with Acadian archaeology at this point.
I had enough background in Acadian archaeology that that I'm pretty confident that we didn't miss anything there. And the other thing was that there was a guy working at Archaeological Services for Chris Pirmble at the time. His name was Gilles Bourque. And he did a background paper on Acadian occupation in what's now Charlotte County in the Quadi region. And so we had that as background information as well. And he wasn't able to find any indication that the French had actually had a habitation on the islands. So that's that was a disappointment.
Yeah, still looking for that smoking Saint Ange, basically.
The smoking Saint Ange, sure. We used to call it that when we were in the field. It's funny you'd say that.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
I thought that was the kind of jacket you wore while drinking Flip and sitting out with your cannon at night.
Yeah, really. Eh?
So you sort of expanded that long human ecological approach, I guess, into the historic record here.
Yeah, to come back to your question, the other thing was that when we realized that that site was a shell bearing site, because that wasn't clear on the surface. Okay, then I had all these visions about, well, maybe this will help us. Because it's a historic site and we have a historic background, it'll help us understand something about indigenous shell-bearing sites that we didn't know before. That didn't work out quite as well as I'd hoped, but it did teach us some things. For example, there are all these fairly rare small species of shellfish that show up in indigenous sites like Hiatella arctica, and you don't want me to use those names. So Arctic saxicabs and the little periwinkles that are native to North America, and barnacle shells. And
wait, Dave, sorry, I know we weren't going to do this, but I thought we were supposed to say that Littorina littoria were Norse.
No. Littorina littoria come later. I'm talking about the little Littorina species that are indigenous to North America, okay? Those and Astartes shells, and there's a whole series of them, Cyclocardia. They show up in small numbers in indigenous sites, and we always wondered, why do those show up? They're clearly not food remains, okay? Well, the interesting thing for me is that they show up in the Loyalist site, too.
Well, that is interesting.
That if you do certain kinds of artifacts, or if you do certain kinds of activities close to the shoreline in the Quadi region, those kind of species, those kinds of shells end up on your site. And if your site's the kind of site that's going to preserve them for more than a couple of hundred years, you're going to find them if you do an archaeological excavation.
Sort of like a bycatch thing, eh?
That they were coming on maybe in clumps of seaweed, maybe attached to boats and other kinds of fishing equipment when they were brought on site, something like that. Okay, so that struck me as interesting. Now, you mentioned Littorina littoria, and we'll pass over the whole Norse thing, but that's one of the reasons why we know that Sam Bliss's homestead was abandoned very soon after he died in 1803, and that it was never reoccupied, that the house either was salvaged and moved away, or it completely collapsed. And that area was never reoccupied, okay? And the reason we know that is because there are no Littorina littoria shells in the Loyalist site.
Really?
Littorina littoria is very interesting. It was introduced into the Maritimes from Europe in the 1840s. First shows up in Pictou, Nova Scotia in the 1840s. Probably wasn't in the Quadi region in any numbers until the 1870s, okay? So they were not there when the Loyalists were there, and there was not enough human activity on that site to introduce any of them. All of the other indigenous sites and historic sites on the Bliss Islands that we've tested, if they had historic activity on them after the 1870s, or even storm damage or anything like that after the 1870s, they have Littorina littoria shells incorporated into them.
Really?
That's really interesting.
Oh, wow.
So Littorina littoria is an indicator of recent terminus historic disturbance.
That's really interesting.
It's an indication, what is it, terminus I'm going to get this backwards.
Whether it's an antiquem or a postquem.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember.
There was a young woman at the University of Southern Maine who wrote a, I can't remember if it was an honors thesis or a master's thesis. I think it might have been an honors thesis on that very topic about 20 years ago.
If you can find that, Dave, we'll throw that in the show notes.
I'll see if I can find a reference to that.
That'd be great. Because Metcalf, who you mentioned earlier, he'd done some work on this topic, hadn't he?
He'd done a little bit of work on Littorina, but he'd had his fingers on a whole bunch of different shellfish pies. But he was the one who was studying the hard shell clams at Sam Moore's Pond, just outside of St. Andrews, because technically hard shell clams shouldn't have been living there, given their known distribution. And so we think they may have been introduced there by historic period people in a place where they happen to thrive. It's
what the shell, as they say in the business, I guess.
So we're cognizant of the time and we've covered kind of a lot of ground. Is there something else that, like, sort of a closing sort of anecdote about either the fieldwork itself or maybe about Sam Bliss's life, the archaeology there, something that you want to share with the listener, want them to kind of take home that's not, you know, a mast blasting cannon sitting in the front yard?
Tell us your second favorite thing is what we're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I do, and I want to preface this by thanking you guys for inviting me to do this presentation on Sam Bliss. I hadn't really thought about this research very much for the last decade, and so this was a chance for me to actually think about it a little bit again and do some internet searches and see if there was anything new. And so that was fun. It was really productive, and it was good of you guys to ask me. So I will give you. So for about 20 years, I used to every couple of years, I would do an internet search to see if there was anything new on Sam Bliss. That's how I found out about the Elihu Ashley diary, which was published in 2007. Okay. So in closing, what I'll do is I'll give you another one of those little tidbits that Chris Blair and I did not know about. When we were publishing the couple of articles that are published on it, okay? One of the things that we found in the faunal assemblage that totally mystified us in the field, it wasn't until we got back to the lab and Francis Stewart identified these things for us that we understood that we had found the spines from spiny dogfish.
Okay.
Okay? There is at least a dozen of them from the excavation area that we worked in, okay?
They're a small shark, right?
Yes.
Am I wrong?
Yeah. Spiny dogfish are these nasty little ugly sharks that are quite common in the Kwadi region, okay? The technical name for them is Squalus acanthius, okay? And they have these two nasty little spines that stick up in front of their dorsal fins, okay? And I'm not exactly sure what they use them for, but they're really nasty. Apparently, if you cut yourself on them, you're really likely to get an infection. And so it's one of the reasons why you have to be really careful handling those critters. Okay, so the rest of the shark's skeleton is cartilaginous, so you would not expect that to be preserved in the site. And of course, we didn't find any other indication that there had been shark carcasses on the site. Okay. We couldn't figure out why would they be catching those little sharks. They could have been catching them as bycatch, I suppose, but why wouldn't you just throw them back overboard if you weren't going to use them for anything? Why bring them onto land next to your house, okay? So we speculated that they might have been eating them. I mean, shark's edible. It's just not everybody's cup of tea. Given the kind of fussiness that we detected in the loyalist diet, as indicated by the faunal assemblage, we thought probably these folks are not eating sharks. But, you know, you can use shark skin as sandpaper. You can do various things with it. So we were just perplexed by it. And you can see that Chris was still perplexed by it when he published that chapter in Underground New Brunswick. What I found out was years later was I was reading Moses Perley's survey of fisheries in the Maritime Provinces from the 1850s, which you can get online. It's a Google book scan thing now, okay? And one of the things he talks about is this tradition in Nova Scotia of people capturing dogfish and drying them and preserving them and keeping them and feeding them to their pigs in the wintertime.
Oh.
Now, Sam Bliss had pigs, okay? At least there are pig bones in his dooryard. And I suspect that that means he had a pen of pigs out there on the islands. Pigs would be very well adapted to the kind of environment that's out on those islands. They could look after themselves to a large extent. And so they would have been a good animal to have out there. And they may be one of the reasons why that end of the island has been so successfully deflected vegetation-wise, because pigs will do that, okay? Yeah. So anyway, I think that probably this is part of that tradition. Sam Bliss would have learned about that in Nova Scotia because he was there. So they started catching these ugly little dogfish. They dried them and fed them to the pigs in the wintertime.
It lends a certain je ne sais quoi to the bacon. That's key, I think.
Yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah, exactly.
We could start a whole new rage. I mean, everybody's doing stuff with bacon these days. We could do shark cured bacon.
Certain terroir. That's
the flip.
Exactly.
I think we've actually got a meal plan out here. You know, we've got to have some Littorina, you know, have some periwinkle shell on the side and a big grog of flip and maybe some dogfish pig.
Yeah, farm to midden.
Yeah, and yeah. Gabe, you've got colleague connections to Louisburg, so you should see if you can use those connections to get the smithy up there to make some loggerheads for us.
Ooh, that's
a great idea.
That would be ideal, actually.
Or just to make loggerheads for the tourists, even.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've basically fleshed out our next live podcast.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
and then maybe we'll hunt clay. We'll do the clay pigeon thing. We'll go skeet shooting. That seems like the right activity for
with muskets, though.
With muskets, yeah.
And a cannon.
Well, I've tracked down three cannons in Keswick Ridge, so you know we might have the munitions to do this. So
that's perfect. Dave, I think we're probably all looking at a half-finished bottle of Courvoisier or Courvoisier Flip here, so we should probably let you go. But we really appreciate you coming on to tell us about this site as our second installment here of the Great Sites issue that we're doing here, and we appreciate you sharing about this site with our listeners. It's the first historic site we've done as a great site.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It's historical archaeology. As we've talked about, I've become more and more interested in this. This site seems like somebody needs to go back and find the Saint Ange and maybe try to track down this cannon.
Thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Dave. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
So Ken, we've got some hit pieces this fortnight that are going to hit the listener with the same vigor that a piece of bar shot winds its way through the rigging of a vessel. And these are the first two hit pieces are actually kind of interesting. Together, they comprise the most recent Maine Archaeological Society bulletin. And in reading this, I was reminded of this phrase that used to exist. It felt like in the title of everything. In Maine archaeology, which is a Holocene cultural sequence. So everyone was making these Holocene cultural sequences. But anyway, there's a site in Maine that hasn't really been extensively published, but it's apparently exists or it's going to exist in some kind of a report that includes the phrase a Holocene cultural sequence by Nate Hamilton and John Mosher. But in the interim, we've got two hit pieces. The first one by Karen Mack. And this is the Rumford Fall Ceramic Assemblage and Maine Ceramic Period 2 Pottery. That's CP2 Pottery. And that's in the Maine Archaeological Society Bulletin. So CP2 Pottery is actually really interesting because it's one of these artifact forms that seems to radiate out of basically the Great Lakes region. And kind of these, it's basically a form of dentate pottery that it's called different things depending on where it is. You know, is it your Point Peninsula or whatever? But out here, you know, we follow the Peterson-Sanger ceramic sequence, which fits into a Holocene cultural sequence, and we call it CP2. And so that's the first article in the Maine Archaeological Society Bulletin, and it's also it's worth getting in the hard copy rather than the scan if you're thinking about that, because the pictures are really good and useful references. And then the second one is by Rick Will and Karen Mack, and it's called Rumford Falls and Beyond, a comparative analysis of archaic period and ceramic period lithic debitage assemblages. So, Ken, that's more down your alley than mine. You know, you can kind of squint at debitage. But
We discovered my main archaeological society membership may have lapsed, so I got an email to Art Spies coming up here.
Yeah, there you go. I finally broke down and got the lifetime one because I figured, unless something happens, that will pay for itself. But I was a little worried. You know, I sent in for that, and they said they seemed to think that was a good investment on their part. And I was like, you know, what are you thinking here? Right. But anyway, lithic debitage is kind of an interest of Rick Will's. He's written about debitage in Maine before. I confess I haven't actually gotten to this paper yet. It's in the stack of stuff behind me, but it looks interesting. I've skimmed it. So that's, again, Maine Archaeological Society Bulletin, Volume 63, Issue 2, well worth your time. And then I think, Ken, we've done a bit of time travel, and I may have suggested last fortnight that this episode would be the CAA episode, but that's not quite true. So this is going to be a bit of foreshadowing for our CAA visit. Is that right, Ken?
Yes. So this will come out after the CAAs, but this will foreshadow what we are talking about in the CAA episode. I think if we have our time traveling correct.
Yes.
So the listener will be listening to this after the CAAs have concluded, but before the CAA episode comes out.
Right, I believe. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. No promises, so, listener. No promises. But the but we're sitting here in our TARDISes, and if you don't like, here's what we do, listener. If you don't like the order that these come out in, listen to them in a different order.
Exactly.
It's the power of technology.
We're not a narrative. What is that? What's the term we're serialized rather than, isn't that how it works?
We've had this discussion, I think, before, and I can't remember.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what the term is for, shows that don't,
But
anyway,
you can enjoy us a la carte is what we're saying. We're not the
exactly
price fix. Yeah.
Yeah. Anthology is the one that's unrelated. Oh, so we're an anthology podcast.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had an anthology once, but
she predeceased your uncle-thology. Is that the joke?
Precisely.
Wanted to highlight a couple contributions from your co-hosts here at the CAA. So the podcast is actually going to have its first sort of publication, I guess, conference presentation. So this is a poster that Gabe and I and Emmanuel, our producer, have put together called Welcome Back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, Podcasting as a Tool for Public Archaeology.
That's archaeology, all one word.
All one word. That's archaeology spelled archaeology. So that'll be up in the poster session on the Saturday morning at the CAAs.
Are we going to try to find some way to drop that online so the listeners can get
Yeah, we'll post that on, we'll find a web space for that. Worst case is I put it on my academia page and we can link just link it.
Yep.
So that's the first thing. Gabe, are you doing any papers?
I'm the second author on a poster by Emily Drakia, which is about modeling. It's basically building a predictive model for finding loyalist archaeological resources in the Grand Lake Meadows with Emily Drakia, who the listener has heard from. She researcher in Black Loyalists and is starting grad school at McGill.
That's fantastic. And I am the second author.
She's done grad school here. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a second author on a poster created by an undergraduate student who she's graduating in June. She worked with me doing an independent study in the fall in my lab, and I hired her on as research assistant, Kiana Barron. And so her poster is called Roots of Research, a personal narrative of Indigenous heritage in the research lab. Kiana is a Métis woman
And one of the things that she's found is working in archaeology has, she's really felt a connection to her own indigenous heritage and kind of shares how working with Wabanaki lithics and bringing in her sort of approach to archaeological analysis and how she's thinking through archaeological issues as an indigenous woman working in the field. So kind of a pretty interesting and very personal perspective from Kiana. So congratulations, Kiana. That's also her first sort of conference contribution or publication.
Congratulations. And we should try to get both her and Emily on for a minute to tell us about their work, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, so Kiana will be at the conference, so we'll do a short interview with her as well, yeah.
And then, Ken, I understand you're starting the revolution in cultural resource management.
Yeah, oh yeah, I forgot about that, actually.
It's not going to be televised, is what I've been told about the revolution. So
I'm in a panel discussion, and I'm going to get the name wrong here. It is called Roundtable, The Critical Need for a CRM Trade Association in Canada. And so this is being put on by Richard Grubb, who is a member of ACRA, which is the American Cultural Resources Association. And they're essentially a trade association for CRM in the States. I'm not really involved in the organization of the panel, but I'm one of the people who is talking about the CRM industry more broadly, along with my colleagues at University of Calgary, Lindsay Amundson-Meyer and Matthew Monroe, who I'm working on this industry study that we mentioned in the last episode. And then the final thing I'm doing is there is an organized session, The Dude Abides, Reflections on Professor Gary Copeland's Career and Influence in Canadian Archaeology. So Gary Copeland, my PhD supervisor at the University of Toronto, just retired a couple of years ago. And so a group of his former PhD and master's students basically developed a session in honor of him, and I'm presenting a paper called It's Only Rocks and Holes, But I Like It, and Maybe Convinced Gary Too. And so Gary is a Northwest Coast complex hunter-gatherer archaeologist who studies households, his last PhD student was me, who was looking at hunter-gatherers on the East Coast and focusing on lithics from throughout the region, with very little sort of detail at the household scale. It's going to be the Now for Something Different paper at the end of the session.
And that's great. And Gary is it's delightful to see that session, because Gary's as you've pointed out, he's a super nice guy, super interesting archaeologist. He's also one of these people that's had a hugely outsized influence, I think, in Canadian archaeology. I think you mentioned something like 7 of his PhD students or 6 of his PhD students are in faculty postings.
Around the country. The majority of his like master's students went on to do PhDs. Many of them are in faculty positions today. Kind of interesting, actually. His first master's student is Pete Dawson.
Oh, wow.
Was his first master's graduate student, who is Pete Dawson is a faculty at the University of Calgary. And so kind of interesting that the first time we met, he was like, "Oh, you're Gary's PhD student." I said, "Yeah, I'm his last one." He was like, "Well, I was his first master's student." So we bookended Gary's career and both ended up in Alberta.
That's right, Gary Copeland, father of Alberta archaeology, right there.
Yeah, really, eh? Yeah.
All right. Well, listener, we are looking forward to seeing some of you in Saskatoon, which I guess we already will have done by this point. And we are really appreciative again of you tuning in with us every fortnight, and we always appreciate just these opportunities to chat with you. And so that's it, I think, for this Great Sites episode. Thanks for today for tuning in, and we'll talk to you in a fortnight, listener.
Yes, thank you, listener, and we look forward to talking to you in a fortnight, and we look forward to seeing you all. As Gabe said, we have already seen you, but right now we haven't yet, so looking forward to it.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you too, Ken, and hopefully this time travel thing, we don't get sort of ripped in part in the airplane, Indiana Jones style, as we're cruising yeah. towards Saskatoon, and then we, you know, end up in some time travel type moment.
Yeah, well, I'll bring my loggerhead, and I'll see you in a week in Saskatoon.
If I can get mine through the airport security, I'll see you there too, Ken.
Excellent.
See you later.
Thank you.